Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
How are the knees feeling after that first jog of the new year? Well, joint pain is one of those things which can make life really difficult for us as we age. And in fact, joint disease is the single biggest chronic illness affecting older Australians. And it's not just older Australians. Younger patients are also presenting to doctors with sore joints. Well, many of these problems can be sorted out with non-surgical approaches like weight reduction, drug therapy or physiotherapy. But sometimes the joint just needs replacing. Luckily, Australia is one of the world leaders in joint replacement surgery and there are incredibly successful outcomes from it. And to tell us about the latest advances in orthopaedic surgery, the history of it, and to answer some of your questions is Dr. Andrew Ellis, who's the Vice President of the Australian Orthopaedic Association. Andrew, welcome to Nightlife.
Well, thank you, Melanie. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, can you give us a brief overview of the history of joint replacement? Who were the pioneers?
Sure.
Etc.
Well, joint replacement surgery really began imaginatively more than 100 years ago. But the problem was infection, prosthesis design, biomaterials, the sort of materials. And it wasn't really till the 1960s and 70s that it became more readily available. And we now stand on the shoulders of those giants, usually people in the United Kingdom and the US, but also mm-hmm. the techniques were very quickly brought to Australia and practiced in Australia.
So today, how many joint replacement operations would there be per year?
Well, there's about 110,000 hip and knee replacements, slightly more knees than hips, about 60,000 knee replacements and about 50,000 hip replacements done a year, but also shoulders and elbows and ankles and even big toe joints sometimes are replaced these days.
And what are the sort of, what's the average age of somebody getting
sure.
one of these?
Well, the best age to have your joint replacement is in your 70s to 80s, when most people are in good health, mm-hmm. when they're not actively involved in physical work, and in good health. So that's a good time to have it. But we're seeing more older Australians, Australians in their 80s, and more mm-hmm. younger Australians, patients less than 50 sometimes, having surgery as well.
Right. What are the common causes of
sure.
you know, the problems
why?
That would
yeah.
yeah, why do you need
why,
one?
Yeah. Why should it be done? Well, the most common cause is osteoarthritis. Now, osteoarthritis, you mentioned it in your introduction, huge burden of disease. It's a common condition, affects many Australians. Probably one in eight Australians have some degree of arthritis. And the pain and distress caused by arthritis has been measured as being quite severe for a number of people. It mm-hmm. can impact on their life, the impact on the ability to work and to recreate, and it can impact on their health. So quite a high percentage of Australians have osteoarthritis. Not so many need to come to joint replacement, and we mm-hmm. look forward to managing it. Yeah, we're possible without surgery, but should they come to surgery, you know, it's a very good outcome for them.
Before we go to surgery, what are some of the recommendations that you do make for people with osteoarthritis to
sure.
before surgery?
Yeah, well, the osteoarthritis strategy for the nation's just been released last week. So it's a collaboration of medical doctors, physiotherapists, surgeons, mm-hmm. And other health advocates around how to manage osteoarthritis. And one of the best things, I heard you talking earlier about exercise, and moderate, frequent exercise is very good for your joints.
Mm-hmm.
Weight reduction, trying to keep your weight down to a healthy lifestyle level, that's the number one priority. Gentle exercise and weight reduction, both thought to be very good for joints.
Right.
Working well with your general practitioner, your physiotherapist, your allied health practitioner to work on an exercise program that suits you. It's not all exercise with people with joint pain mm-hmm. is that easy. You can imagine that. It's got to be, you know, carefully managed. But we do know that exercise and a healthy lifestyle will improve that threshold until people need to come to surgery.
Andrew, I've got a couple of friends who've got arthritis, osteoarthritis, and they both say that when they stop eating sugar, it gets better. Now, is
sure.
that kind of snake oily, or and is there any, you know, empirical data that would...
There's so much, Melanie, that's subject to a lot of discussion and research, And it comes really to the basis of what is knowledge, what is science, at what level do we accept a threshold about something. You might have heard also about medicines like glucosamine and fish oils and other things that people say are worthwhile trying. The evidence on those is a bit softer, you see. But the evidence on exercise and weight reduction, very strong.
Right. If you've just tuned in, you're hearing from Dr. Andrew Ellis, who's the Vice President of the Australian Orthopaedic Association. How do you know it's so bad that you have to actually go to surgery?
Yeah. Okay. So the things that we look to see are restriction in walking distance, pain that's frequent, pain that's I often, when talking to my patients, say, is it dominating? Is it there all the time? Is it there every day? Not just pain that comes and goes. Does it wake you at night? Does it stop you from doing things? Does it stop you from walking, you know, more than 30 minutes? Does it stop you from being able to go to the shops, catch public transport? They're the sort of levels at which we start to see the serious impact and we start to have conversation about surgery. So it's not just small amounts of pain. It's consistent, constant, unremitting, that's gone on for some months.
Right. So do when it gets to that stage, you've got your private patients, you've got your public patients. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the public patients. How long will they wait for this surgery?
Well, we'd like to see no difference between the choice of patients about insurance. But in New South Wales, the waiting time is about 1 year for surgery. So from the time that you'll see the surgeon to the time that you have surgery is about a year. In some hospitals, it's less. Some hospitals, it's a bit more. Generally, it's considered to be a reasonable length of time. Personally, I'd like to see it a little bit less. Probably a good time would be around 6 months. You don't want patients to suddenly rush into surgery, think about having an operation and then have it next week. The consequences of this nature of surgery, big surgery, need to be very carefully considered by the patient, sometimes their families, and often by the other treating health practitioners who are working with them.
Mm. And is it for the private patient, is it almost immediate?
Can't be within 6 or 8 weeks. Right. In other words, there's a little differential there for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are the sorts of things that families and people that are getting the replacement surgery, what are the sorts of things they need to keep in mind before this? Like, what changes will there be in their life afterwards?
So the first thing for them to remember is that if you've reached that level of pain and discomfort where it's constant and unremitting and serious, the joint replacement surgery does offer, and you've exhausted all the exercise and the physiotherapy and the simple pain relief and the other methods to try and prevent your surgery, and they must be very strongly encouraged. What happens is that you want to weigh up the risk versus the benefit. The benefit is that it clearly improves quality of life. It clearly is generally successful. Mm-hmm. But it has a risk profile which is serious, and up to about 5% of patients can have a serious outcome that they wouldn't be necessarily happy with from surgery.
So, you know, they might have bunged up knees or the like, or?
No, they might have a couple of things. They might have had an infection. So risk of infection, hospital-acquired infection, is about 1 in 200 cases. So that's 0.5% of people.
Right.
And that's got to be considered. And that's a big fight to recover from if that happens. Mm. And so that's the infection's one thing. There can be mechanical issues with the joint replacement, for example, dislocation in a hip replacement, also about 1 to 2%, and that can sometimes mean further surgery. There's risks of having clots that might travel to the lung, about 1 in 200 risk, and they can sometimes be even fatal. So these are very serious considerations that a patient needs to make to discuss with their referring GP and with their orthopaedic surgeon and with their orthopaedic surgeon on more than one or two occasions before surgery. It's something that isn't a, oh, yes, I'll have this next week sort of operation. It's something that has to be thought of. And we spend a lot of time about educating patients in choice, trying to help them know when that tipping point is, when is the point to say, now's the time for me.
Andrew, what's the actual technology? And feel free to get as gruesome as you like.
Well, it's really interesting. I said before that we stand on the shoulders of great people, and What I would say is that the technology now is better than the technology of 20 years ago, and I'd imagine that the technology in 20 years will be better than the technology now. There are lots of variations and lots of choices, the choices of implant, choices of the surgical approach, choices of rehabilitation. But if I wrap it all up and say that we work really hard as a collective healthcare team to reduce pain and discomfort from surgery. So these are things associated with enhanced recovery to make your recovery easier and less painful and more tolerable and better outcomed, through to surgical techniques, through to the actual biomaterials. These are the materials that are implanted in the body.
Yeah.
The fantastic thing about the materials that are used, often titanium type implants, is that they actually become part of your body. The bone grows and fixes to the... It's the most amazing thing. Bone grows to the titanium and fixes them, so the implant will become integrated or part of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's led to a huge benefit in terms of predictability about the implants. The risk of the implant loosening, for example, which is a risk, has become much more reduced over the last, let's say, last 5 to 10 years, with implants that are more predictable in the way that they grow into you. The use of surfaces where the two parts move against each other. So in hip replacement surgery, the use of highly polished ceramic surfaces, for example, and polyethylene or plastic or ceramic cups that are very durable and don't wear out.
Mm-hmm.
So wearing out of the mechanical part was a big issue. It still is an issue, but it's a better issue with the materials that we're using today.
So that's interesting. Titanium, ceramics, etc. Are they going to be heavier than the actual bone that they're replacing?
Everybody asks that. And I have on my desk to give to a patient to hold a hip replacement and a knee replacement, and they all ask exactly that same question. Now, I allow them a little bit of grace. I say, well, look, you can allow yourself about 500 grams to 750 grams extra, which is what they weigh.
Yeah.
Bone's quite heavy,
and
we remove some bone to replace it, and the actual implant is not that heavy. It doesn't weigh you down, for example, but it has to be strong enough not to break.
Right. It's interesting. My mother's just had a double knee replacement, and she's had a really terrible time, actually.
Sure.
And that was one of the things we were talking about, you know, in the caring for her in the weeks after. We're like, I wonder if you're going to weigh more. Wonder if you get, but only 500 grams.
Well, yeah. It's
or a kilo.
Up to we allow between 500 and a kilo. It doesn't allow you much extra weight. And you're right to sort of say that sometimes, you know, the joint replacement recovery is not as straightforward as it might be. And that's what I was trying to mention in that decision making, to make sure that you're really ready for it and that you have a very good discussion about weighing benefits versus risks up. And that's a really important thing. I'll just tell you one other interesting thing, that in America, about 25% of joint replacements are being done as day-only procedures now.
Are you kidding?
Which is hard. Your mum's just had a double knee, you just said. And so that's hard to imagine that.
Yeah,
but that's where we're, with these enhanced recovery programs, moving towards even sort of outpatient surgery of this nature.
So that's not America just being, you know, America's health system leaves a lot to be desired. Is that part of that, or is it that they're having
It's a bit of both,
technology?
I think, Melanie. Yeah,
right.
I think it's both a cost saving but also a patient enabling thing. So with particularly around hip replacement and some knee replacements, it's very possible to do that safely. So they know that the in selected patients it's okay. It also gets them out of that hospital environment, which has a potential risk of infection and things like that.
So we've got a full board of calls. We're going to have to get to them in a moment. But I just want to touch on the recovery for a moment.
Sure.
The outcomes, you were saying when we were talking before you came in, you were saying that they generally end up being about the same no matter how long your recovery process is.
Yeah, there is a variation, of course, in how individuals respond to it. And, you know, you still meet some people who say, it's the best thing that I ever had.
Mm.
And that's the most consistent response. But occasionally you meet people who say, look, I wish I hadn't had it done. It was a bit too early, or I was sorer than I expected, or I had this big clot and I wasn't expecting that. So part of what we really work hard on nowadays is expectations and education, and that's not just the doctors talking. So we get our patients talking to our physiotherapists, and we get them talking to our nurses, mm-hmm. and we get them talking to other patients, and we try to give a perspective that's not just medicalized.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, it affects the whole, well, it affects the whole family, doesn't
it? It's the most important thing that'll happen in that family, you know, for most of them that year. So it's a very important thing that everybody is well supported, and it takes a family to sometimes to get through that operation.
Yeah. It's what sort of, just on that, for people that don't have families, what kind of help is provided for them?
So there's quite a lot available through rehabilitation. So we're working generally towards trying to work to outpatient rehabilitation rather than inpatient rehabilitation, but there's potential for inpatient rehabilitation. There's potential for a lot of support from community services and things, and generally the hospitals will link patients up with those things, hopefully before they have surgery, so that there's a good plan. And most people can tolerate their recovery from surgery without necessarily having inpatient rehabilitation, for example, having outpatient programs. And a lot of the health funds are running them. A lot of the rehab hospitals are running them now, sort of like a day hospital where you go to the day, you go there for the day and do your exercises, and you're supported through that very tough time.
And those rehabs often have transport as well from home.
Yeah, so they'll run buses or things like that, and sometimes they'll do rehab in your home. So some of the programs will have a physiotherapist come and visit you two or three times a week. So there's a variety of ways. The general thing is to try and keep people out of hospital, and not to hospitalise your recovery, but rather to enable you to recover in your own home.
Well, let's go to these very patient callers now. Okay. And if you've just tuned in, Dr. Andrew Ellis is with us, Vice President of the Australian Orthopaedic Association. Darren, you're on the road. Hello to you.
How are you?
Well, thanks. How are you?
Good. I'm 55. Yep. I had my hip done when I was 21. I'm starting to wonder how much longer is it realistically going to last, and two-pronged question if I can. You know, because I've got to go into the public system, when it's got to be done again, will I be treated the same way as someone waiting to have their first one and wait 12 months, do you think?
That's a really good question. There are two good questions, actually. The first one is how long do they last, which is like on the tip of everybody's tongue. And what we generally say is that for most people, they last most people's lives. Okay, now you're very different because you're a young fellow when you had yours, 21 years of age, very special. Mm. And you've had it now for 34 years.
Years.
That's amazing. And so the clock's on that one, I'd say, Darren. And that probably every 3 or 4 years it's worth popping in, having an X-ray with your local orthopaedic surgeon. Yeah, and it's just getting it checked out. Having it done in the public hospital system, mustn't be worried. The standards in our public hospitals in New South Wales and Australia are very high, and the techniques that are used are just the same in the hospitals, exactly the same, I have to say. The rebuilding technique can be more challenging. So the second time surgery, just today, we did a very complex second time operation. And we used a three-dimensional titanium implant. So we heard us talking about titanium before, but now we can shape these things and print them out especially for you. So individually for a patient, most amazing sort of thing. So the second time surgery shouldn't be too much of a worry for you.
Good luck, Darren.
Thanks for that.
Thanks for calling in. And let's go to Noel now from Broadwater in Western Australia. Noel, what would you like to ask Andrew?
Hello, Melanie and Andrew. Yes, I've been told that I'll need to get rid of a manual car and get an automatic, and I go bush. There's some of those things that are worrying me, and I do a lot of sort of getting down, kneeling and scrabbling around, and there's a possibility of dislocations.
So this is for your hip replacement that you're having soon?
This is for a hip replacement that I'm due to have,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, look, that's not advice that I've ever given somebody to say, stop driving a manual car, but you can understand that they're probably trying to advise you to avoid repetitive load on the new hip. But you'd find that opinions vary about that. Look, I think with our new techniques about dislocation, we just tell the listeners that the risk of dislocation between 1% and 2%, a little bit dependent on surgical approach. That's the approach the surgeon uses, but the dislocation nowadays, we tend not to worry too much in the younger patient about patient with good muscles, a well-positioned hip, and there are lots of interesting technologies using computers and various other things that help us align the implants fantastically. And generally speaking, functional use of a hip replacement to avoid kneeling is no longer common practice.
Thanks very much, Noel.
Thank you.
So good luck to you, Noel. It sounds like you've got an interesting life out there.
Okay. Yeah, it really does. Good luck. And Karen from Melbourne. What's going on with you, Karen?
Hi, Melanie and Andrew. I'm 65 and I was diagnosed as having very bad osteoarthritis.
Yeah.
Haven't seen the surgeon yet at the hospital. I'm waiting on a letter, but I think there's about a 12-month waiting time.
Sure.
Being 65, I'd much rather wait till I'm 75.
Sure.
The trouble is I have, because I hear it only has a 10-year lifespan, but I have trouble when I'm walking. If I walk about 5 minutes, then I've got to stop and rub the back of my knee, because that's where most of the strain is, and then start again another 5 minutes, and it goes on and on, you know?
But
I'm wondering, does this get progressively worse? Do you think I'll last another 10 years?
Well, first of all, osteoarthritis is a slowly progressive condition. So nobody needs to rush into a decision about joint replacement surgery, and that generally the slow decline occurs over years rather than months. Though some people might rapidly decline and then it become very obvious to you because you hardly get to the letterbox. You're in the quandary that a lot of people are in, relatively young but affected by pain, and that's something to speak with your surgeon about, and I'm pleased to see that you're going to have the opportunity to do that. The reason is the surgeon will give you advice and measure you up, if you like, against other people that the surgeon has, that he or she have seen in their experience, and they can talk to you about where you fit and individualise your treatment for you. It's a very common issue, and it's one that your surgeon will be very able to help you discuss.
Thank you very much for your advice.
No worries.
Thanks a lot.
I'm saying no worries. It's all Andrew. Sorry about that, Andrew. Thanks for calling, Karen. Have a good night. Bye-bye. And let's go to Sheila in Wellington, New South Wales. Hello, Sheila.
How are you?
Well, thanks. How are you, more importantly?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
I'm returning to work tomorrow after 6 weeks of having a new knee.
Very good.
And in November 2017, I had my left knee done.
Mm-hmm.
I've just had my right knee done. And I had terrible arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was very deformed from a knee reconstruction and the second one was just worn out.
How did it all go for you?
Gone really well, thank you. Yeah, and I went to Sydney and had it, and I stayed down there for rehab because of the time of the year.
Yeah.
And it went really well.
Well, you're a long drive from Sydney, so it's sometimes good. Mm. That's certainly for our country people, when we're talking about rehabilitation, that's something to really consider that. And any words of advice to people considering it? You've had two knee replacements. What would you tell them?
Go for it, because I had terrible pain. With the first one, I didn't. But with this other one, I've had terrible pain from August to end of November.
Mm.
And it was extreme night pain. It wasn't.
Sure.
I worked. It wasn't worrying me during the day, but night pain. It was just excruciating, blood-curdling.
Sheila, do you work on your feet?
Yes, I'm a nurse.
Right. Gosh. So you would have seen probably a lot of people get them done as well at the hospital, did you? Have you? Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
But no, I really recommend it.
Oh, well, thanks for calling in.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Good luck at work tomorrow. Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jackie now in Beverly Hills in Sydney. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I'm not quite this is just a question that I thought, oh, my gosh, this would be the perfect person to ask. I found out something weird recently about my hips. My mother had told me, you know, at some point years ago that I had to wear two nappies when I was born because I had clicky hips.
Yeah.
And then it was only a couple of years ago, one of my sisters referred to my stupid boots. And I was like, what are you talking about? And apparently it was a little more than the nappies. I had boots and they were attached to a stick of some kind.
Yeah.
So
called the Dennis Brown splint. Now, Dennis Brown was a famous Australian
yep.
who practiced in the United Kingdom. And you probably had a condition called hip dysplasia, which affects about 1 in 1,000 Australians.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis Brown was a pioneer in the treatment of that. And well treated, it often prevents or delays the need for hip replacement surgery till much later in life.
Oh, okay. Well, that's exactly what I was. I just thought, I haven't had any problems with my hips, but I thought I should ask if it's going to be, I'd have a propensity.
No, you should ignore it. Carry on with your life.
Yep.
And thank goodness for those wonderful Australian doctors of years ago who diagnosed and treated you.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Jackie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go to Richard, who's calling from the beautiful Whitsundays. Hello, Richard.
Oh, beautiful Whitsundays. We're waiting for a cyclone right at the moment.
Oh, crikey. A beautiful cyclone. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Oh. It's only just going to be a depression anyway, so it won't be too bad.
Yeah. Okay, but Richard,
overall,
Richard, what do you want to ask Andrew?
Basically, Andrew, like you did say that it's osteoporosis and arthritis, but basically, you know, where does it come from?
Yeah.
Like, so, I played football for years and everything else. And,
sure.
Yeah,
so first of all, osteoporosis and osteoarthritis are different conditions. So osteoporosis is a condition where the bone loses its calcium or mineral content. A little different, so we'll put that to one side. But most common cause of this is osteoarthritis. About 90% of the need to have hip or knee replacements comes from osteoarthritis. Some of it comes from injury. So part of the new strategy is to protect from injury and to make sure that injury is well treated, particularly in our young. In youth, in athletes, in children, and there's been a lot of work done by good people around child safety in sport to try and to reduce joint injury. Osteoarthritis probably is a condition of the cartilage, and it's probably comes in your genes, and it's probably programmed in you. You might in your mum or your grandma might have seen the knobbly fingers of that people have with arthritis, and you tend to that tends to run in families a little bit. And sometimes it's just one of those things.
Yeah. No, I can understand where you're coming from there. I saw my mum. She had really bad arthritis there for a long time.
That's right. So sometimes it's a bit like a cyclone in the Whitsundays. It just comes in unexpected.
Yeah.
Richard, thanks for calling. Have a good night. We have an expert, so expert in this field that before Andrew Ellis, Dr. Andrew Ellis, you preempted a question that was written up here on my screen, and you knew even our hip dysplasia friend, you knew that before she even asked the question. So that's what we're dealing with, dear listener.
It's a common thing, Melanie. that particular hip dysplasia is really common, and it's often asked. Yeah,
I want to ask a quick question about jobs where you're on your feet all day.
Sure.
So nursing, shopkeeping, etc. How they are higher risk for knee and hip replacements. Yet we're told to exercise more, and both of those jobs, you're exercising a lot as well.
It's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? We know, for example, that in high level athletes, so first grade AFL players, first grade cricketers, particularly people who are really actively involved in those aspects of sport at a high level, have a high incidence of knee osteoarthritis, not necessarily of hip osteoarthritis. And we've heard a little bit how other conditions like the hip dysplasia come into play. And so it's hard to say one thing across the whole spectrum of everybody. We do know that lifestyle intervention is high value. High value means that it gives a good reward to patients through activity. So we're talking probably not standing on your feet in a shop for 8 or 10 hours a day, but spending 2 or 3 hours a week, maybe up to 5 interventions a week for up to an hour of gentle exercise. Exercise that's aimed at muscle strengthening, helping you with weight reduction and not impacting too much. We know that if you're doing too much impact loading, you know, those athletes, for example, that makes your arthritis potentially a little bit worse. And into that, not every marathon runner
becomes crippled.
Not every marathon runner develops arthritis. Mm-hmm. But there's a huge genetic interplay and an individual interplay into all that. Yeah,
Andrew, we've had a text saying my mother was told she might need knee replacements, but she discovered regular Pilates exercise and that's improved her joints.
Yeah. So at our hospital in Northern Sydney, Ronos Shore, fantastic colleagues have developed a program called the Osteoarthritis Chronic Care Program. And we now send all the people that used to come to us for discussion about joint replacement, we send those patients for this integrated, for better pain relief, specialist physiotherapist working in osteoarthritis, nutritionist to work with rate reduction, psychologist to help them with their managing of pain and knowing when is right. And that's seen a drop in our number of patients coming to surgery by about 15%.
Wow.
So it's been very effective. And even for those people that it hasn't stopped them coming, it's got them better prepared for it. Mm-hmm. So you'll see that New South Wales Health has rolled out programs like that. And across Australia, other health jurisdictions, other health departments are doing the same, trying to stop the drive to joint replacement without doing something like that ladies' Pilates class, which sounded great.
Let's go to Pam from Casino now. Hello, Pam.
Hello.
What would you like to ask, Andrew?
I'd just like to ask a question. My partner, he turns 88 at the end of February.
Yeah.
But he's got a pacemaker as well. And I'm just wondering, on both knees, he's in a nursing home as well. He's got a bit of dementia. But I'm just wondering, is it worthwhile speaking to a specialist or anything? Because his local doctor says he's too old. I don't know.
Sure. That is a really, really good question. And this year, in our big report from the National Joint Replacement Registry, we looked particularly at the risks of surgery in patients over 80 and patients over 90. Mm-hmm. The first time we published on that. And the answer to it is that if you're generally healthy in that age group, there's not an increased risk of death from surgery, which is a fundamental part of the question that you're asking.
Yeah, so but, having a pacemaker, that's okay. What I was wondering.
So as you start to have more complexity, it gets a little more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is that we can more safely do surgery for patients in their 80s and 90s if they're healthy enough. And that then comes back to a discussion where you get an opinion or a second opinion. In some places, in one of the hospitals that I work at, both of them actually, we have special physicians called orthogeriatricians who work with our elder patients having joint replacement surgery. And their aim is to improve the outcome and to make sure they don't have the confusion consequences or the heart attacks or various things that you're a bit worried about there. So I'd speak to your GP again and say maybe there's a chance and maybe I could get your partner checked out by a specialist physician and see if he's good enough or not.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much.
Thanks Pam.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
How are you going tonight?
Yeah, painful.
You're in pain, are you? That's no good. What sort of pain are you in?
Oh, well, I had a car accident about 2 years ago. I had a B-double grain truck hit me and I went over an embankment and
suffered.
My fracture joints were damaged in the accident.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, I'd had a system off work, so I was paid out or whatever. And I had 2 spinal surgeries. And the
goodness.
Whole lot was... It just I get bad cramps and pain. I just had a nerve block done in my neck, and I've had nerve blocks on my back. But the pain management now want to reduce the pain medication, but it's still not helping.
Right. So you're in a lot of discomfort at the moment, by the sound of things.
Yeah. Well,
sounds like a lot of that's spinal. Is that right? It's in your back.
Yeah, I've had 2 spinal surgeries done by Nicky Martin.
No, no need to mention the name.
Yeah. So
I've got 2 knee joints which are pretty bad and a hip.
Mm-hmm. And what did you want to ask Andrew tonight, Peter?
Well, is it worthwhile, like they put in these nerve blocks and everything else, and like I get my shoulder was damaged in the accident.
Mm-hmm.
And both my knee joints had it, you know.
Mm.
My knee joint only bent halfway.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess one of the, you've got a couple of questions there, and one of them is when you've got a whole lot of pain all over, how do you know about your hip and knees? What's the best decision trigger for that? And the other thing is, what's the best when you've got a whole lot of pain everywhere? Now, you sound like you're under the supportive management of a pain management team, if you're talking about nerve blocks and things like that.
Yeah, and, I said that about 2 weeks ago.
And they'll be pretty good at helping sort out the various elements of your pain. It is possible to target hip and knee pain separate from back and other pains. Generally, a cautious approach is chosen when you've got sort of upregulated pain like you've got. Cautious approach, but there is a role. We work with our pain management team sometimes and work around trying to isolate the hip and knee pain, which is what we're talking about tonight.
Thanks. Yeah. Good luck to you, Peter.
Thanks.
Have a chat to your pain team because they sound like they're switched on.
Good luck, Peter. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Brian now from the Sunshine Coast. Hi, Brian.
Hey, good evening.
Brian, what, did you have a question?
I do. Just a brief background.
Mm-hmm.
I suffered from hip pain for about 5 years, non-stop, worse in the evening. And I decided not to get anything done until I couldn't walk any further. Mm. I got off a plane in Perth and couldn't.
Oh, dear.
And then had the first one done within 6 weeks, the second 6 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
And I had titanium and ceramic ball and socket. I didn't even have any pain after I had the operations.
Yeah.
And it's been absolutely fantastic.
Oh, great.
And the only limit I place on myself, I still do everything else I always did, is I don't jump off the third rung of the ladder. I go down to the last rung and step off.
That's good. I hope you tie your ladders to the tie your ladders too. That's one thing that
very important.
Very important, ladder safety, because
there's more accidents on ladders than in the workplace.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely. People cleaning out gutters, and especially with hip and knee replacements.
Yeah.
I tell them don't climb ladders if possible, but if you're going to, be as cautious as you can. You've given us a really good point there, which was wait until you couldn't go any further.
Andrew, I've got three siblings, all in the medical profession.
Yeah.
And they beat up on me for years to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I wasn't going to get it done until there wasn't one more metre in my legs.
Sure.
And I don't regret that at all.
Yeah, well, I think that's good advice to give to our listeners, is to don't jump in too early. But when you have it done, the result can be, as we've heard from yourself and from our nurse in Wellington, can be a very good outcome.
Yeah, Andrew, I have a question, a quick one. I had it done in 2006, which is some 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If I need to have the ball and socket replaced, do they carry spare parts? And
yes,
they
do.
Can they just replace the ball and the socket?
Yeah, they can. Yeah.
Good. So, I had a minimally intrusive operation.
Yeah. So generally, the current implants are designed that parts can be replaced. Interestingly, it only is a small part of the revision or second time surgery, but definitely it can be done.
Yep.
And, you know, these new joints seem to be very durable. Of course, it's a long game and we're following them through the National Joint Replacement Registry. Now it's nearly been 20 years and we're one of the best registries in Australia. We're following that data set for all Australians. Fantastic.
Sounds good.
Research.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
Brian.
Good.
Hello, Peter from the Hunter Valley.
G'day, how are you?
Well, thank you. How are you doing tonight?
Not too badly.
I'm glad to hear it. What would you like to ask, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I've got double curvature of the spine, and I had, hip dysplasia.
Yeah.
As a child, my GP, who was quite brilliant, my right shoe built up by about 2 inches, which made only...
Often with that double curvature, you can have a big difference in the lengths of your legs. You're right.
It then stopped doing that. And when I go dancing, when I got in my teenage years, I'd sort of dance for about half an hour, and then I'd start dragging a leg. And anyway, long story short, I end up getting manipulation and done by specialists in regard to that. It was very difficult to find doctors that do it. I eventually had a break in Newcastle, a specialist in Newcastle. A professor used to do that for us, and he got us up walking again. I was laid up for nearly 2 years on my back. But now I'm finding the both the knees to sort of start killing us. I mean, I've been in pain for nearly 20-odd plus years. I don't take any medication. I was taking occasionally anti-inflammatories, and then when I went to see a specialist about kidneys, he said, bloody anti-inflammatories. and I'm wondering whether or not a hip replacement or the knees done would make any difference.
Well, we can't say that.
I used to exercise heaps now, and I find a very difficult ride push bike. I still walk, and I push through the pain. But I'm finding it's sending me a bit crazy with the pain. I don't like taking painkillers.
Your question is, are you bad enough to have your hip or your knees checked out? What role does that have? Now, what I'd say to you is that visiting a surgeon doesn't mean that you're going to have an operation.
No, really.
So
like
it's
that.
Quite good to get a checkup and say, what am I state? Well, how do I compare to everyone else? What do you think? And you'll find that most Australian surgeons are very well trained. They're highly expert, and they'll be able to work with your GP and come up with a plan of advice for you, which might be something like, you're too good at the moment, wait a few more years.
Well, do they want the pain?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You got to tell them, and we can't obviously go
into
that too much on that.
I had the scraping sort of stuff done.
Yeah.
And then I went back and then had x-rays, and the bloke said it's okay. I said, well, what's causing the pain? So the last lot of x-rays, I thought about it, and I thought, well, how about x-raying the leg straight and also bent? And then when the x-ray was laid, it was done with a bent leg, it showed up that there was a big bloody problem there.
Peter, we're going to have to move on. We've got lots of calls, not much time. So you better get off
so
to that surgeon.
I've just got to continue on with the pain.
Well, get it checked out, mate, is the best thing. There's one last thing I'll say on your way out, and that is that scraping operation used to be commonly done, called an arthroscopic cleanout.
That's
the one. Has no role these days.
No, I know. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
yes.
Doesn't work.
I'd found
just
that
for
out.
The other listeners, yeah. Okay.
Thanks very much, Peter. Let's go to Jeanette now in WA. Hi, Jeanette.
Hello, how are you, Dale?
Well, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I've got a question for Andrew here. What does he know about the PRP platelet replacement injections?
Yeah. So that's a really good question, because the question is, what are the roles of things other than surgery and other than exercise and simple pain relief and weight reduction? And a lot of those things fall into a situation where we're at the edge of knowledge. Platelet-rich plasma injections are designed to stimulate the body's natural healing, to attract your own stem cells in the reparative process. And some of the data looks promising.
Yep.
So that's where it is. It's not recommended yet by government as a PBS rebate, which means it hasn't reached a level of evidence that says it is absolutely beneficial. And I'd say buyer beware is the attitude of it. But
really?
But, well, in the sense that we don't know. I send some of my patients off for PRP injections, and some of them report benefit, and some of them say it didn't make much difference, and the evidence is not very strong. But
yeah, well,
there
we were told by a pain specialist today, actually, in Perth.
Yeah.
It's about 50-50 whether it'll work or whether it won't.
Yeah.
She has said, well, like, I'm looking down the barrel of a full shoulder replacement.
Sure.
And, you know, we talked about that today, and I thought, well, it sounds a lot better idea than an operation to me. Yeah.
Good luck, Jeanette.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's go to Margaret from Battery Point. Margaret, good evening to you.
Oh, good evening, Melanie. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hello. Hi.
Andrew, I had a double knee replacement 6 months ago yesterday, and I'm still suffering quite a lot of discomfort. I have trouble getting up out of a chair unless I can hold on to things, onto the arms of the chair. And I'm wondering whether this recovery is normal.
Okay, so what I'll say is that there's a variation in individuals. There's what I tell my patients, a bit like hare and tortoise sometimes, and that sometimes, especially the double knee replacement, which is a very big operation to have, though commonly performed, it can really knock you back and take a while for you to get back onto your feet. And sometimes patients can have pain for 12 or 18 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm not taking any pain relief.
Well, that's a good sign that it's not too bad, yeah.
But I'm just a bit concerned that, you know, I can't sit for any length of time without there being a degree of discomfort, nor can I stand.
I'd say to you, at 6 months, that's not uncommon. And I'd say remain very hopeful. If you're not taking pain medication, it's good. I would say keep up your exercise and strengthening, so don't let your discomfort lead to a weakened state. It's very easy to get deconditioned. Mm-hmm. Keep working hard and keep hopeful and keep in contact with your surgeon.
Well, the surgeon said I'd hate the sound of his name for 6 weeks, and 6 months later I still detest his name.
Your surgeon in Tasmania says what I say a lot too, and that is that you won't like the look of us after a knee replacement for the first few months. It takes a little while.
Honestly, had I known what it was going to be like, I would never have had it done.
Sure. People often say that at the 3 to 6 month mark. I would say to you that commonly the tune is changed by the 12 to 18 month mark. So I wish you good luck.
Good luck, Margaret.
Thanks for calling. Thank you, Millie.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Bye.
Let's go to Manuel now. Manuel, you're in Canberra. What would you like to ask about?
Yes, thank you very much for the segment. I opted to do some stem cell therapy. I had pain in my hip, which I had an ultrasound done in 2014, 15, 16, and I decided to go to stem cell. And so I had some harvesting done and all my blood and stuff on my stomach. Then I went 8 weeks later and I did the first injection. This was in September of 17. And I found that within 2 months, the pain had subsided because I was really limping. I couldn't even bend down to do my shoelaces. And it was good. Then I went back for the second injection 6 months later and it was good. But now this is 12 months on, and I'm finding that the pain is there now. And the decision, I suppose, is, do I continue to pay more money to go for the stem cell, or do I do my hip replacement? That's sort of the dilemma I'm in.
Okay.
Well, I think in the very short term, you get an opinion from a surgeon who can talk with you and weigh up your individual state versus other patients that the surgeon might have seen. Stem cells are really promising for the future. The evidence at the moment is that there, you know, it might be said that's not ready for prime time, meaning that we're a little uncertain. It is an expensive treatment. The evidence is mixed about it. I think we'll know a lot more about the safety of it. Unfortunately, the studies that show safety and efficacy and show a definite benefit to a high level of scientific evidence, and they take five or 10 years to do, and there are lots of people working on them right now to show it. The thing is, what do you do when you've tried a treatment and it's been partially effective, but you feel you're deteriorating? The answer is talk with your GP, talk with your physio, talk with your surgeon. Information is power. Doesn't necessarily mean you've got to have an operation, but at least you'll get an idea of where you're heading.
Thanks very much, Manuel. And we've got probably time for this great quick question now from Marina. Marina from Balmain, Sydney, what would you like to ask Andrew?
Good evening. I've been keeping up for more than 3 years, from January 2015 to May last year, 2018. I was keeping a problem knee at bay with physio and massage and exercise and all that, swimming and all that sort of stuff. But then in June, I fell and fractured my hip. And it wasn't fully replaced, it was pinned.
Yeah.
And I've got to, I think, get a pin out of there in the next month or so because it's still painful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the physio says that because of the, I'll see the surgeon at the end of January, but I'm interested, the hip thing seems to have made the knee worse. And she says it's the glutes or something like that. I don't understand all the technology. But I was interested, you said that the knee thing was there was a 5% lack of success, whereas I heard 25%.
So,
and I'm really a bit alarmed about having to get the knee done.
Marina, can I just interrupt because we've only got a minute and a half to go.
Yep.
You wanted to know how hips affect knees and vice versa, is that correct?
Yep, and what the percentage really is of success or otherwise with knees. Yeah.
Thanks, Marina.
Very quickly, in the last few minutes, I'll say that there is an effect from your hip fracture, or could be an effect from your hip fracture on your knee, and it could be wasting of muscle. So that's a lot of the things both for primary joint protection. The physios will work a lot on strengthening to try and offload joints and to help. I'd say it's a bit early to say since you've had your hip fracture. I was talking about a 5% principal complication in knee replacement, so the major complications up to 5%, but patients up to another 10% can be dissatisfied, like one of the patients we heard today who's still struggling a little bit at 6 months. So something that requires a bit more discussion, but about a 5% principal complication rate.
Marina, thanks so much for calling in. And thank you to you tonight, Dr. Andrew Ellis, who has answered all these questions. I'm so sorry we're not going to get to any more calls, but Dr. Andrew Ellis is the Vice President of the Australian Orthopaedic Association. By the looks of our text line and all the phone calls that came through, Phil's going to have you on again, Andrew, to answer all these questions. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Melanie. It's been great.
That's Dr. Andrew Ellis, Vice President of the Australian Orthopaedic Association.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.